and welcome to Worlds Apart. Hopes, disappointments, violence and farce. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict has been through so many shades of forced futility that it's hard to imagine any dignified resolution anymore. Is there still any room left for it to get worse and hopefully eventually get better? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Mustafa Barghouti, Secretary General and co-founder of the Palestinian National Initiative. Mr. Barghouti, it's amazing to see you in Moscow. Thank you very much for talking
Thank
to
you.
Us. I know that you've been committed to nonviolent resistance and grassroots democratic growth for quite some time, and it has universal appeal, but do you think this kind of peaceful political engagement can deliver and sustain any national aspirations anymore in our time? Because, you know, it's quite unruly.
Well, as Gandhi said, nonviolence is not passive. And sometimes people mix up between nonviolence and passivity. On the contrary, true nonviolent resistance is very resistant. Given what we've been through, without denying the right of the Palestinians to struggle in any form that is legitimate by international law, and that is what international law says, that people under occupation have the right to struggle against occupation in all forms. Without denying that, I think for the Palestinian coming period, as it was before, the most effective form of struggle will be the popular resistance. And I think that's what we need more than anything now, especially in the face of the Israeli de facto measures, which are nothing but continuous efforts for achieving ethnic cleansing, displacement, and annexation of our land.
You've been an observer and active participant of international politics, and I want to ask you, why do you think it has come to a point where diplomacy is almost irrelevant, almost obsolete, and not only in your conflict where clearly it's futile, but also in many other international contested situations?
The problem is much bigger than many politicians think. In reality, the international law was slaughtered in Gaza. And the slaughter of international law in Gaza is now reflecting on the whole world. And I think the fact that Israel was allowed to kill international law and violate it in such a horrible manner, allowing three war crimes to take place at the same time, the war crime of genocide, the war crime of collective punishment, including starvation, and then ethnic cleansing, the fact that it was allowed encouraged many other parties in the world to violate international law. And that's why what happened in Palestine and what's happening today has very important meaning for the whole world.
Mm-hmm. I've heard some experts suggest that this very dysfunctional and distrustful state of international relations can be traced, at least to some extent, to that fateful 1947 UN decision to split Palestine into two states, which over time sort of encouraged creeping and very corruptive state of mind on the part of Israel and its own supporters. Do you agree with that, that it doesn't only end, but also begins with the Palestine?
To some extent, yes. The 1947 resolution was not just for Palestinians, and I'll explain why. Because it divided Palestine and gave the Palestinians only 44% of the land at the time when they owned 82% of it. That division partition plan would have created a situation where you would have had 480,000 Palestinians and 490,000 Jewish people in the Jewish state, versus almost 500,000 Palestinians and only 10,000 Jewish people in the Palestinian state. So it was not fair in any way. Yet, that partition plan was not accepted, not only by Palestinians, but also by Israelis. One of the biggest myths in the world is the claim that Israel accepted, but Palestinians rejected. It's not true. Israel never accepted the partition plan. And if it had accepted it, it would have created a state on that part. But no, they went and violated the Palestinian part. Avi Shlaim, who's an excellent Jewish Israeli academic, did a very thorough research, and he said he could not find a single indication that any Israeli leader accepted the partition plan. Yet what you say is correct. In my opinion, maybe it started from there, but what we ended up in Gaza is the disappearance of the whole international order that was created after Second World War.
And this is what I want to actually ask you about, because as you said, for quite a number of decades, there was at least an effort to keep the appearances, you know, multiple rounds of negotiations, some deals struck, even some effort to uphold those deals. But eventually it would always come to the same outcome of Israel wanting what it truly wants. And I know it's hard to see anything positive in the current situation, but don't you see a silver lining in at least exposing the Israeli-Palestinian issue for what it is? You know, a land grab with an intention to push people out, the Palestinian people out, one way or another.
Absolutely. And the ethnic cleansing did not start now. The whole idea of the whole situation of Palestine is about the ethnic cleansing that Israel conducted in 1948, when it displaced 70% of the Palestinian people through massacres. They conducted so many massacres. And what is really horrifying is that the same methods that Israeli terrorist gangs used in 1948 against Palestinians by groups like Haganah and Itzel, who became the Israeli army eventually, the same methods are now used by gangs of Israeli terrorist settlers who are now attacking Palestinian communities in the West Bank and who have already displaced more than 60 communities. In reality, the same pattern repeats, and the world is allowing that.
And that, because the world has been there from the beginning, first as a benevolent observer who gave promises to the Palestinians that their state would eventually materialize. And now it's just as an observer which cannot do anything. Now,
Absolutely. And here there is a very important point. Palestinians for a very long time demanded that there would be one democratic state on historic Palestine with everybody living together in equality, I mean, with equal rights and equal duties. The world pressured the Palestinians, the whole world pressured the Palestinians to accept an alternative solution, which is called two-state solution. And on that basis, there was recognition of the Palestinian state, etc. Now the big question, while Israel is slaughtering, even after Palestinians officially accepted the two-state solution, Israel is now slaughtering that option and annexing the whole of the Palestinian territory. And the big question to all Western governments and to all countries, actually, of the world, you claim you support two-state solution and you see Israel slaughtering the Palestinian state. Why you are not imposing sanctions on Israel?
I can answer that very easily for all the Western governments and all the other governments. It's because promises given in international politics are not kept. And my question to you now...
And that means for us Palestinians that we should not rely on international law.
Absolutely. Well, I'm afraid that it may mean for your people that, you know, the rights that apply to others may not apply to you. And as painful as it is to state that, unfortunately, that's the current reality. I want to ask you, though, do you think it can get any worse after everything we've seen over the last couple of years? Do you think it can still get worse?
It is getting worse now, while we are talking. It is getting worse because Israel is confiscating people's homes, people's lands. Israeli terrorist gangs are burning people's houses, burning people's cars. Israel is planning strategically a process of ethnic cleansing in Gaza and in the West Bank. Of course, it is getting worse. And that's why I think the most important issue for us now is resilience, steadfastness, not to allow Israel to force us out, but the world community must be asked to impose sanctions on Israel. And the first countries that should impose sanctions on Israel are the Arab and Muslim countries. Some of them have deals and agreements with Israel. Israel is not respecting any of that.
Do you think they are likely to do that?
I think the public pressure will increase on them, on the governments. And I think many of these governments are now beginning to see that they are themselves threatened. Because what, if you look at what happened to Israel the last 10 years, you will notice that it has systematically killed the possibility of peace based on two-state solution. Second, that the Israeli community, not only the government, has shifted towards fascism. Third, Israel has moved into the direction of becoming an imperial superpower, that regional superpower that wants to control the whole region. And if you follow carefully the line of Israel during the last 40 years, you will notice they were trying to destroy any other force in the region. They marginalized Egypt, then they pushed for destruction of Iraq. Now they are pushing for destruction of Iran. And they are attacking not only Gaza and West Bank, they are attacking Lebanon, attacking Syria, attacking Yemen. Israel is trying to become the sub-agent for the United States as an imperialist regional power. Mm. And that means a lot of things, not only for countries like European countries, but also for countries like Russia, for countries like China, who are targeted also by these tendencies globally.
Well, I think Russia and China now have a lot of issues to deal with, a lot of things to think about in their own neighborhood. But you mentioned the allegation of fascism, and it's been thrown around for emotional purposes so much in recent years that I think it lost its intellectual and analytical substance. What makes you believe in hard facts that the Israeli system is moving in that direction?
Well, several laws they have passed. For instance, the state-nation law, which was supported not only by the governing parties, but also by the opposition parties, which says that the right of self-determination on the land of historic Palestine is exclusive for Jewish people. They're imposing Jewish supremacy here. Second, now their most recent decision to approve a law of execution of Palestinians. Third, the crimes that they've committed in Gaza. You know, in Gaza, they killed civilians left and right. In Gaza, Israel killed and injured no less than 250,000 people. That is 12% of the population. More than 75% of those were women and children. 21,000 to 22,000 children killed. I notice sometimes that there is a big gap between people's knowing something and realizing what it means.
Or feeling it on the visceral level.
12%, apply that to the United States of America. You would be talking proportionally about 35 million people killed or injured in 2 months, in 2 years. Apply it to Russia. You would be talking about 18 million people killed or injured within the course of 2 years. That's horrible. Not only that, they've left the country with 30,000 orphans. There are 6,000 people who have amputations, including 2,000 children. The level of atrocity could only be compared to fascist behavior, in other words. And that's why what worries me is not just that certain parties in Israel are fascist, and you have people like Smotrich, the finance minister of Israel, who calls himself a fascist homophobe. It's not only that. What worries me is the shift in the Israeli public, which reminds me only of one incident in modern history similar to that, which is what happened to the German public during the Nazi time in Germany.
But I mean, the reason why it happened to the German public is that because they were silent observers, to some extent, the so-called international community who is standing by is also exposing itself to all those crimes, and they become somewhat more acceptable even for their own populations because they you know, as there and not defending.
But the best people who can understand what's happening to us are, in my opinion, the Russian people. Why?
Absolutely.
Why? But, because Germany burned and destroyed more than 70,000 villages and towns during the Second World War in Russia. Exactly what's doing, what Israel has done in Gaza, abolishing whole cities, whole neighborhoods. When you look at Gaza, you see things you didn't see even during the Second World War.
Mr. Borgudi, I have to stop you for a very short break, but we will be back to this conversation in a few moments. Please stay tuned with us.
There's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the earth.
It's the case of the madness of the people.
I tried to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is all so absurd.
This is third world lunacy. Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals?
What planet are we living on now?
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Mustafa Barghouti, Secretary General and co-founder of the Palestinian National Initiative. Mr. Barghouti, before the break, we were talking about the fact that even being a passive observer makes you exposed to the crimes committed against other people. And, you know, you cannot fully insulate yourself. Maybe you can on an emotional level, but, you know, this corrosive influence spreads throughout the international politics. And we see it play out in many other conflicts as well. I mean, I don't want to distract our interview towards Ukraine, but, I mean, to some extent, you know, some of those issues are also being deliberated on the front lines. But I think to both Russia's and Ukraine's favor, they do have certain state structures to defend themselves, unlike the Palestinian people. Now, you talked about solidarity, and many people express solidarity with the Palestinians on a popular level. But when it comes to the state level, I don't think at this point of time any state has enough resources to put enough pressure on Israel's main sponsor, which is the United States.
I don't agree with that, if you allow
why
me.
Why not?
I'll tell you why. First of all, the public pressure has been very effective. And the only reason why Israel had to stop the genocidal war, of course, they didn't stop shooting, but the whole scope of genocide was stopped, mainly because of the public pressure. The public pressure that affected the behavior of many governments. And as the American president said, Trump, he had to interfere to break the isolation around Israel. That's what he said when he came to the Knesset justifying his peace plan. And he said he came to save Israel from isolation. I believe that's true. This is the main reason why the war stopped. But after the stopping of the declaration of the ceasefire, we've witnessed some decline in public pressure. And that's what we have to reactivate again, especially after the Israeli most recent resolutions. Public pressure affects governments. That's why you see Spain imposing military embargo on Israel. That's why you see Belgium following that line. Of course, the main supporter to Israel is the United States. But even in the United States, there is a change.
Okay. I'm sure you would want to take that change to perhaps a more expressed, bigger level. And my question to you is, what do you think the Palestinians or other countries can do to make the Americans and their blank check support for Israel and make it a little bit more structural, not just, you know, Trump saying something, but, you know, changing the policy of the whole country?
Change the Congress and change the Senate. And that's what will happen in November. There will be big changes. The election of Mamdani as a mayor of New York was not a single phenomenon. You can see that according to most recent statistics, 64% of Democrats support the Palestinian rights. The very impressive change is among the Jewish young community in the United States, where 40% of Jewish young people now support the rights of the Palestinian people. And I think increasingly you see people who understand that the suffering of the Jewish people during the Second World War is no justification whatsoever to what's happening to Palestinians. So many people now see that there is no difference between Anna Frank, who was killed by the German Gestapo, and Hind Rajab, Palestinian little girl. There is a film about her now that is competing in the Oscar, about who was killed and assassinated for no reason, 6 years old girl. And in my opinion, this change is going to happen even inside the United States of America.
Mr. Barghouti, the question I have here is, how do you close that gap between very active, passionate expression of solidarity? The Western societies are very good at that. You know, you can organize a 1 million march in support of the Palestinians, but it does not necessarily translate into lasting, incremental, sustained governmental change, because people can vent their anger, they feel good about themselves, they are on the right side of history, but that doesn't necessarily move the situation for your people on the ground.
Absolutely. And the reason for that is that while you have public pressure pushing the governments and parliaments in certain direction, you have very powerful Israeli lobby, which is pushing in the opposite direction, and they use terror. I mean intellectual terror. They terrorize politicians. Look at what they've done with Epstein. I mean, using Epstein and his scandals to blackmail many politicians in support of Israel. Now there are so many indications that Epstein himself was an agent of the Israeli Mossad. So yes, there is a lobby that is powerful, but I think the path we're going to have is very similar to what happened in South Africa. In South Africa, first the people changed. And then the parliaments changed. And then the last to change was the United States of America. I remember giving an interview to CNN at one point when Mandela was the most famous president in the world, and every American president wanted to have a photo opportunity with him. During that time, Mandela was still, I mentioned that, was still on the terrorist list of the American Congress. So imagine how slow the change was in the United States, but it changed.
Mr. Barghouti, I don't want to be too argumentative. I also find the South African example very inspiring, but I think one factor which makes me skeptical is because the Cold War situation, for all its faults, was structurally very different from what we have right now, because there was actually, you know, some degree of respect for international law. There was structural solidarity. Imposing sanctions meant something. Whereas when you look at the current international system, everybody essentially is for himself. You know, each country is concerned about, you know, their own interests. Do you think that the South African case, as inspirational as it is still relevant structurally?
Yes, and I'll explain to you. Today, international law has been substituted with power. Power is the law. In our case, we are confronting the power of arms with the power of the people. I believe in people. I believe in humanity. I believe in justice. And I believe that the power of the people will eventually overcome the power of the arms. What is Israel? Israel is a little entity with a huge air force and with a huge military support from the United States, which exceeded, by the way, $50 billion.
Which is a huge factor. Yeah. let's not minimize it.
$50 billion. $50 billion.
And they have been very successful in creeping onto
right.
the
but
lands
they
that were
still,
granted
and
to you.
They will be still a small little entity that is trying to swallow much more than what it can chew. Mm. And that is going to be the objective reality that they cannot overcome. Besides, we're very resilient people. We're very steadfast people. Some people yesterday mentioned in the meeting here that maybe it's Israel's bad luck that they are trying to abolish a Palestinian people who are very, very stubborn. And maybe it is our bad luck that we have to face this kind of aggressiveness. But I believe in our people, and I believe that, you know, you ask any Palestinian anywhere in the world, even those who have been displaced for more than 70 years, you ask them, where are you from? They will still mention to you the name of the village, the name of the city that was demolished already, that they came from. So the Palestinian cause will not vanish. We are people who do not vanish.
Mr. Berguti, you compared the Palestinian cause to some of the Russian experiences before. And as a Russian, I fully resonate with being resolute and stubborn and resilient. But I think that's not enough, definitely, to advance your national aspirations. And the Palestinians...
It's not just national aspiration.
Well, it's aspiration. Human aspiration.
Yeah, it's aspiration for freedom and justice.
Absolutely.
Which is even bigger than the issue of nationalism.
Well, to some extent, they're related, but that's not the point. My question to you now is, the Palestinians in the past, at least, have been accused of a certain degree of intransigence. And you can argue that that was a natural response to Israel's very forceful policies. But as somebody who is involved both in politics and in social life, how would you evaluate the Palestinians' ability, strategic ability, to argue for themselves? Are they good negotiators? Are they thoughtful enough providers, strategic, perhaps cunning enough thinkers to strategize how to use the situation to their own end?
We're getting better. And what is really impressive is the younger Palestinian generation, which is really much more knowledgeable, much more capable of objectively analyzing the world and analyzing the proper strategy we should follow. The only flaw we have, or the only major flaw we have, is the internal divisions. And that's why I consider that our main duty, and my main duty as a person, is not only to struggle for our rights, but also to try and do everything possible to get us all unified under one unified leadership. I think that particular aspect is very crucial for the success of our struggle. But when I see our younger generation, I am so impressed by their capabilities, their skills. And I think we've learned how to be more strategic, how to be less emotional, and more capable of planning about how we should do things. We still need a lot of dialogue about what happened in the past, what are the best forms of struggle we should use, what is the best strategy we should follow. But to be honest with you, there are things I wrote more than 20, 25 years ago about how we should struggle. And I'm really pleased to see that so many people now believe in these things that they didn't believe in 20 years ago.
Well, it's hard to find an inspirational note to end an interview on, but I think we have just succeeded. So thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.